Hello and welcome to episode number 10 of Mark's Mess vs. the Evolutionary War, the 12-issue limited podcast. In each episode, I will be looking at one of the Marvel 1988 annuals with the banner of that Evolutionary War. I will examine both the main story and the backup, and in the 12th and final podcast, only two podcasts away, I will take a look at the High Evolutionary story, which runs at the end of nearly all the annuals. This time, in this episode 10, I'll be looking at Spectacular Spider-Man Annual number 8. Spectacular, Spectacular! If you want to contact me, you can contact me on my email, which is mymarksmess@gmail.com, or find me at Twitter at marksmesspodcast, or, I don't know, send up a flare. Anyway, straight into this one, because we've got a lot to cover. This is one of those covers I like because it's a simple background. It's Spider-Man in an alley, he's in the foreground, he's about to climb up a wall when he turns around and he sees someone. Oh no, not again, Gwen Stacy is back! Yes, that's right, it's Gwen Stacy, who we all know. Well, we do kind of know now because of the recent movies. But before that, she wasn't that well known. This is back in 1988, and I was, 17 at the time? And I'd never heard of Gwen Stacy, or who she was. She was his first real love, and if you follow what is said now, it's the most romantic thing. But when Jerry Conway, who's a scripter of this comic, he first went on to the Amazing Spider-Man comic just on the heels of Stan Lee, he decided to make one change. He would kill the Gwen Stacy character, because at that time, she wasn't really moving the plot forward, and Peter was very involved with Gwen Stacy, but she didn't know that Peter Parker was indeed Spider-Man. Spoiler alert. And this was a classic DC thing, where the wife did not, or girlfriend did not know who the hero really was, and they wanted to shake it up. So in the classic Amazing Spider-Man, was it 121, the night Gwen Stacy died, the Green Goblin kidnaps Gwen Stacy, brings her to the top of the Brooklyn Bridge, or maybe it's not the Brooklyn Bridge, and she gets knocked off. Spider-Man sends a web down to capture her, and she breaks her neck, so she's dead before she reaches the ground, or Spider-Man is able to, and it produces a fantastic story after that. It really makes Gwen Stacy's character a catalyst for a good story, as before, when she was alive, the stories were, okay, it's a girlfriend, oh, I don't know who you are, I hate Spider-Man, yeah, because Spider-Man was meant to, she thinks Spider-Man killed her dad as well. Anyway, skip on. A couple of dozen issues later, and similar to this cover, you have Gwen Stacy comes back into Spider-Man's life. How can that be? Well, it began in Amazing Spider-Man 144, where Gwen Stacy seemingly shows up alive and well, but in number 147, Peter finds out that Gwen is a clone, and realizes in issue 149 that his old professor, Dr. Miles Warren, who's now going by the villainous name of the Jackal, explains Gwen's origin, how he created her as a clone. He brought out her memories through hypnosis because he loves her, and she was the most beautiful woman to him. After the Jackal is defeated, Peter and the clone of Gwen part company in quite a touching scene, where the clone Gwen goes to the grave of the real Gwen. And she does most of the talking to Peter, who really, honestly, doesn't know what to do. She's confused and frightened. And she says this, "Everyone has that moment when they wonder about themselves, Peter. About being who they are deep down. I think I would be better for both of us if we didn't pretend to be the same people we were when Peter Parker loved Gwen Stacy. And she loved him. I wish I could know you the way that she knew you, Peter, but I can't. Because I can't, this is goodbye." Peter goes, "Gwen, maybe if we..." "Don't say it, Peter. Turn your head, and please don't look back." And a really sad final panel of Peter facing away in the foreground, with a tear coming out of his eye, and Gwen clone going off in towards a taxi in the background. Really touching. So it's interesting that, I know, that was, it must have been early 70s, so over a dozen years later, they bring back Gwen. What will it mean for our hero? As I say, this story is written by Jerry Conway again. And Jerry Conway was most famous for his Spider-Man run back in the 70s and doing amazing things there, no pun intended. He was back on Spectacular Spider-Man at this time. The Superior Spider-Man podcast had an interview with him recently, and he sounds like a really nice guy, really down to earth, and really knowing that he did some great things, and maybe not so some great things, but that's his profession, and he made money out of it, so he's doing well. Penciler is Mark Bagley, letterer is Rick Parker, inks Keith Williams, and editor Jim Salicrup. So I could really need to learn these names. The story is called Return to Sender. And just a warning, if you really like Spider-Man and you want me to say nice things about it, turn off now. Let's pretend this was a perfect comic. Let's pretend that the story in this made a lot of sense and didn't drive me barmy, so barmy that it took me months to actually record this. And if you are Jerry Conway, turn off now as well. Let's face it, you've done enough great things in comics to earn the right to think that I'm going to be saying nice things. I'm not going to be going nuts and screaming into the microphone in a minute or two. Anyway, Return to Sender. The first page has Spider-Man sitting on the rooftop on the corner talking about cats. That's my first problem with this. It has nothing to do with anything. There's a cat beside him, he's talking about cats, how Aunt May told him he was allergic to cats, about he needed protecting. You can make a connection to the rest of the story, but it would be kind of forced. Thinks about how MJ is his best friend, his wife, his lover, and in a way that you know it, you need to know this for the upcoming story. Then Spider-Man nearly gets hit by some sort of energy beam and jumps into action. He finds two evolutionary goons firing at a woman from their hovercraft. They tell each other that they have been after this woman since Spectacular Spider-Man 142 and 143, just before this story takes place. Spidey jumps into the hovercraft and makes them crash. Spidey catches up with the woman to check on her, only to find that she is dun 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 Gwen Stacy, his dead girlfriend from years ago. She runs from a Spider-Man, and Spidey is left to fight off the goons until they disappear in a flash of light. Interlude number one. The High Evolutionary is in his underwater HQ. He tells off Dr. Stack for not getting the girl because she is an anomaly. And he must study her. The High Evolutionary then goes on a mission only he can perform. Peter Parker is in his apartment looking through his stuff, trying to find a scrapbook when MJ, his wife, comes in. He tells her that she is back. Why does he have a scrapbook of his old girlfriend? I think if I had scrapbooks of my old girlfriends, that my wife might be a wee bit annoyed with me. Anyway, MJ goes, uh-oh. She knows there's trouble coming. Interlude 2. Now the High Evolutionary comes to the Celestial spacecraft. Oh, the Celestials. I don't know whether to mention who they are or not. Let's have a quick recap of who the Celestials are, because at the end of this, near the end of the comic, there's a wee recap. And here's what it says. 1,000 years ago, the old gods of Earth joined to prepare for the eventual return of the Celestials, super beings whose plan to judge humanity threatened mankind's very existence. Over the span of 10 centuries, 1,000 years ago, 10 centuries, yeah, that's right, the gods chose 12 ordinary men and women whose skills represented the 12 great achievements of man. Endowing these humans with godlike powers, the old gods offered the 12 superhumans and to the Celestials as proof of mankind's worthiness to survive. For reasons of their own, incomprehensible even to the gods, the Celestials adopted the 12 superhumans taking them aboard the Celestial Mothership, where they have remained in constant training, learning the ethos of godhood. Now, perhaps, they are ready to return to the world that gave them birth. But is the world ready for them? Okay, we'll discuss a bit more of them later on, but there's Moonstalker, who's got hyper speed, Varula, who's the mistress of the Unimind, in which young gods mind meld, becoming a group consciousness. There's Calculus, who can do calculations. There's Jedi, who's mind over matter type thing, can create things from other things. Catechus, who's a master of healing. Harvest, who is mistress of all vegetation. There's Bright Sword, who can who's physically indestructible, sort of a warrior, hyper strength, that type of thing. Mind Singer, who has telepathy. Sea Witch, who, guess what, she goes underwater type stuff, she can control water and stuff. High Note, who can use his voice to do things. There's Splice, who does creates things out of things, and Daydreamer, who's a mind controller. So it's that type of super powered beings. Really, I think they were trying to, this is one of those other lost civilizations, this high evolutionary war keeps bringing out. They first appeared in Thor, and they didn't really appear much again, and this was meant to be the big relaunch and never really took off. But anyway, now we have the young gods, and in back to the story, we have the young gods who show off their powers by a training session. While training, one of them senses the presence of the high evolutionary, and they capture him. But he says he's looking for the gods, but only found children, and he leaves. But Daydreamer is able to show the high evolutionary's plans to evolve humanity. And the art depiction here shows humans turning into more of the deviants from Silver Surfer annual. We talked a bit about the deviants. Then they have a philosophical argument about whether they should go to Earth to be protectors, or whether they should be guardians, and what the difference is. But half the group of young gods decides to go to Earth to protect humanity. Meanwhile, back with our hero, Peter Parker and MJ are having a crisis over the Gwen clone, creating insecurity in the marriage when the Gwen clone arrives at the door. She hugs Peter, who still has a spidey suit under his dressing gown, and she seems to not remember the last time they met. She discovered he was Spider-Man and reacted by running away. No! The last time they met in the Spider-Man 149, Amazing Spider-Man 149, she knew that he was Peter Parker, and she seems to have forgotten all about this. Anyway, the Gwen clone runs away. Peter goes after her as Spider-Man. The thing that scared her... Yes, would you not have been safer going out after her as Peter? Or maybe sending MJ, one of her best friends, when she wasn't a clone, after her? Anyway, he and MJ have a moment of melodrama where she accuses him of loving her, and he admits he is confused. MJ gives him an ultimatum. Help her, and when you're done, come home to me with a clean heart, or don't come home at all. A wee bit melodramatic. Somebody turns up out from the dead, and this is her friend as well. Why isn't she going after her? Why is she making this into a big crisis? Women, eh? Whew. But really, this strikes of creating tension just for the sake of it. Why, in the last time she showed up, there wasn't this crisis. Of course, Peter and MJ weren't really together then. Also, the next time she shows up, spoiler alert, in the Clone War, the big Clone War, there's not that tension. In fact, the two get on really well, MJ and Gwen clone. So I think it's creating tension for the sake of it. And really, if you want your husband to come home, you shouldn't really give him such an ultimatum, either come home with a clean heart or don't come home at all. Because sometimes you need to sit and talk about things. Yes, this is my counselor voice. Sometimes we talk about things, talk over how we feel, and give each other room to grow. Anyway, talking about room to grow, Spider-Man finds the Gwen clone and briefly chats about Spider-Man, the real Gwen dad's death in Amazing Spider-Man 90. I love the fact that they put all these wee things in about where that's been seen before in the classic Amazing Spider-Man 90. But the High Evolutionary Goons attack. Peter is very confused about the Gwen clone. So when the High Evolutionary Goons teleport away, he doesn't want to lose her, and he dives into the teleportation beam poom. That's it. That's the sound. The sound goes poom, and he's gone. He emerges right in the middle of the High Evolutionary's headquarters, and Spidey fights to find the Gwen clone again. So it's Spider-Man against all the High Evolutionary's goons in their big silver metal suits, and then come in half the team of Young Gods. Oh, this is where it just gave me a headache. Okay, I'll try and continue with my notes as I can, but it just got devastating. So you've got Spider-Man against the High Evolutionary's goons, who are against the half the team of Young Gods. Okay. So far, in the confusion, Spidey finds a High Evolutionary and sees he is experimenting on the Gwen clone. The other team of Young Gods shows up, and I get even more confused. So Spidey against the High Evolutionary's goons against the half the team of Young Gods, and the second half of Team Young Gods is against the first half of Team of Young Gods, trying to stop them going everywhere. Really? Oh, the two plots smash into each other, and Daydreamer misuses her powers and nearly kills one of her friends, and Spidey is caught by a High Evolutionary goon in a power suit and pulls the Gwen clone from the machine that she's in. Peter and Gwen embrace. That's going to help MJ's mood. Peter pulls away because he loves MJ. Yeah, don't start something if you can't finish it. Weird. Young Gods then decide they will leave and leave it all done and dusted. And then when Spidey and Gwen are alone, seemingly the High Evolutionary's goons seem to have all been dispatched, the High Evolutionary appears. And he explains that A, he learned of the Gwen clone from Professor Warren's files. B, how could a mere human professor create a clone? And C, he didn't. It was a genetic virus that he created. Yes. The thing that we're meant to find hard to believe is that Miles Warren created a clone and not that he created a genetic virus that created somebody else. Turned somebody else into Gwen. That's just... And she's actually just some other girl who was kidnapped by Miles Warren and made into Gwen Stacy for his nefarious needs. Really? Education? Great. The Gwen clone then thinks that she doesn't exist and starts crying. The High Evolutionary does the best thing he can do and sends them all back to New York. Daydreamer from the Young Gods shows up unexpected and turns the Gwen clone back to her original person with the pre-genetic virus form, and Spidey and Daydreamer leave her alone in New York to wander the streets. This is a woman who's just come out of basically a coma, and you're leaving her alone in the Gwen Stacy outfit. Real, that's just, yeah, some hero you are. Not even asking your name, where you're from, anybody we can call. Peter goes back home with a clear heart, because it's not really Gwen anyway, and Peter and MJ declare their love for each other. So much wrong with this story. It doesn't really follow on from the previous Clone saga, the one in the mid-150s. So much wrong with the marriage that this happens. Too many stories intersecting, trying to squeeze it in. Again, it feels like this story was something that the editors went, we need a spectacular Spider-Man annual. We'll do something. You did great in the Clone War originally. Let's bring Gwen Stacy back. Really? And all this is retconned again in the upcoming Clone War, where the next time we see the Gwen clone, or the non-Gwen clone, she's Gwen clone again, who claims that it was all a misunderstanding and she really is the clone of Gwen Stacy. So what on earth happened here with the High Evolutionary in this one page that sort of dispels it all? I don't really know. And also the original clone of Spider-Man, who ended up being Ben Reilly, what does it mean for this? I don't know. I'm just it's really just confusing. I have to say the artwork, I did like the artwork. It was clear and concise, what you expect from Mark Bagley. I'm really disappointed in the storyline, and I think it's just trying too hard to fit into the High Evolutionaries. And why does he need to know this one anomaly? Surely there are thousands of anomalies in the Marvel Universe, like Daredevil. Why? How did the goo that he fell into make him into super sensitive as a superhero and not into a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle? I do not know. But, oh, and you know what? That's not the worst thing. Worst one is the Young Gods backup story, where six of them go to Israel for some reason, and they make the classic blunder of getting involved in a land war in Asia. And then suddenly some monster, huge, angry monster, pops up. They have to try and defeat it. They do that by becoming the Unimind, as described before. It explodes, and they discover that it was actually the gods who created them as superheroes that created it. And this will be continued. Watch future issues of Spectacular Spider-Man to find out where. You'll be watching future issues of Spectacular Spider-Man for a long time to find out where, because the only other time they turned up in the next couple of years is in Marvel Comics Presents. This is the issue that broke my back with the Evolutionary War. It sort of made me realise how contrived the whole thing is. Pushing stories together that didn't really need to be there. Why on earth was the High Evolutionary concerned about the Young Gods anyway? Surely, is it just from an evolutionary point of view? Was he worried they'd intervene? The fact that they're so far away with the Celestials doesn't make any sense, because, again, there are other groups that you could be wondering about. The Inhumans were just on the moon, and he could have wondered about them, and we later find out that they are part of the Kree Empire, or offshoots of that. He doesn't really deal with Deviants, which the Celestials made. It's not great. I don't rate this much. The best bit was the cover. And again, not knowing who Gwen Stacy is didn't help me in my first reading. This is one of the original ones I got. The storyline's quite confusing, even though it's a basic thing. I don't know. Maybe I should just end this here. Because next time, I've got my favourite annual. Got my favourite annual from the whole Evolutionary War storyline, which is the Avengers one. And I'll get to that next week. I am quite excited. And after all, at the end of each show, I highlight a podcast or two that is hopefully related to the comic I covered. And this week, it's the Clone Saga Chronicles. Their first episode actually covers what I've just covered more succinctly and more throwaway, and they cover the rest of the Clone Saga, which was the 90s multi crossover in Spider-Man, where Spider-Man is replaced by his clone, Ben Reilly, first with as Scarlet Spider and then as the new Spider-Man. And it's one of those storylines that at the time people hated. And now enough years have passed for people to go, actually, I actually stopped reading Spider-Man just before the Clone Saga happened. It was actually when Peter Parker's parents showed up and they turned out to be robots. Spoilers again. And so I missed the whole of the Clone Saga. It wasn't until a while afterwards that I got back into Spider-Man. I'm glad I missed it because it sounded hideous at the time. And maybe I'll look into it some other time. But if you want to know about the Clone Saga, Clone Saga Chronicles, perfect guys to let you know about that. They don't have a promotional advertisement for theirs, so what I will do is put on a promo for another podcast that I've been listening to, kind of related to this, because in one of the previous Spider-Man annuals, and I just realised how bad the Spider-Man annuals were for 1988, each of them in Speedball, poof. But that one with Speedball had Daredevil, and Dave's Daredevil podcast is a podcast I've started listening to. I just listened to episode 11 today. Really good stuff. Dave knows his stuff, he loves the character, and you can tell how good a podcast is when they take a topic that you don't really care for that much. Like, I don't really care for Daredevil, but I'm starting to care now because Dave has such an interest in it. J. David Weaver's podcast, so listen to that at the end. This has been Mark Smith's Versus Evolutionary War, episode 10 of 12 issue podcast. All the characters are property of Marvel Comics, and thanks to Josh Woodward of joshwoodward.com for the title music. Next issue, The Avengers.
I prowl the rooftops and alleyways at night, searching for justice. Blind justice. A guardian devil.
No, that's not actually true. I'm not Daredevil. Blind attorney by day and fearless crime fighter by night. No, I am J. David Weider, a podcaster. But you can call me Dave. I do read about Daredevil and his adventures, and I podcast about it on my show, Dave's Daredevil Podcast. You see, it's my Daredevil... You get it. Every Sunday, I read a Daredevil comic and share my thoughts and feelings on the issue, the characters, and the world of Marvel's Man Without Fear in an easily accessible audio form. And I want to take you along for the ride, so tune in each week as we meet Daredevil, his villains, his loves, and more hornhead goodness than you can shake a billy club at. That is every Sunday on iTunes and at www.daredevilpodcast.com. That is daredevilpodcast.com. Take the dare. Listen to Dave's Daredevil Podcast. Did I really just say take the dare?